Support for Father David Abernethy and his ministry at the Pittsburgh Oratory of St. Philip Neri comes entirely from the donations of community members and listeners like you. The creation of future groups and podcast episodes depends on your commitment and generosity. We humbly ask that you consider a monthly gift of $10 to the Pittsburgh Oratory in support of Father David and his work. To make this or any gift, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org, click the Donate button, and write Father David in the notes section. You can also make a recurring or one-time donation directly through Podbean. Your commitment and ministry-sustaining support are greatly appreciated. God bless you, and enjoy the podcast.
Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back to the Ancient Christian Writer Series and our study of St. Isaac the Syrian. And we're picking up tonight with homily 72. So as you realize, we're very far along. And if you're following along by podcast, we're on page 503, about halfway down the page. And this is some of the most beautiful material that I've read in the text, but also the most challenging. And so we want to pray a little extra hard for the guidance of the Spirit, I think, as we go through the text. Some of it's jarring. He talks about the nature of grace and its action upon us, but also the experience of temptation, and even the importance of that experience of temptation in order that we might cling more to the grace of God, and that we might be strengthened in particular virtues. And he also talks in these next couple paragraphs about the nature of hope and even how it emerges, that we often typically, I think, have a vague notion of hope as it is. But he speaks of it here in a way that is a little bit more challenging in the sense that he says that a person has to reach a state of desperation in the spiritual life in order to really experience hope, in this sense of being able to see through the affliction to the promises of God and to hold on even in the face of that experience of desperation. And so it's certainly solid food. I think we want to take our time with it. And don't worry if it seems a little disturbing as we go through it. You know, we'll try to unpack it as much as we can, as we've done with all the other homilies. But this one I thought was particularly challenging. And for those who are, you know, pretty far within the spiritual life, in the sense of being able to embrace it fully. He begins by saying, "As soon as divine grace has made his thinking secure in all these matters, so that he puts his confidence in God, she begins to introduce him to temptations, little by little. She permits him to be sent temptations to his measure, that he may bear their force. But in these very temptations, her aid palpably draws near to him, so that he may take courage, until little by little he gains experience, acquires wisdom, and holds his enemies in contempt because of the confidence he has in God." So, little by little, grace allows a soul to experience temptations, and not in the sense of abandoning that soul to them. In fact, just the opposite, offering all that is needed to engage them, and to engage them fully, in order that through experience one might be able to taste and experience tangibly the nature of grace and build a kind of confidence within it. So it begins to hold enemies, spiritual enemies, in contempt, and having greater confidence in the grace that is offered to us. So going through these experiences allows a person then to experience them in the future with greater confidence, not in the self, but in God's grace, And so to be able to fight them more fiercely and more confidently, even when they seem to be overwhelming us and coming upon us with you know, in a kind of endless fashion, as they often do. For it is not possible without temptations for a man to grow wise in spiritual warfare, to know his provider and perceive his God, and to be secretly confirmed in his faith, save on the strength of the experience he has received in his own person. So no one else can give us this kind of confidence in God's providence, and no preaching about, you know, God strengthening us in the spiritual battle is going to have the same effect upon the soul as our going through the experience of temptation and experiencing firsthand the action of God's grace within our life and helping us not only to persevere through them, but really to engage fully in the spiritual battle, not to see ourselves as passive in that or victims, but rather fully engaged in this spiritual warfare. In the sense that when we first catch sight of these things, to begin to pray in a more vigorous fashion, to be more watchful and attentive to how these temptations might pull us away from God, so that we become more directly involved in the spiritual struggle. So often, I think people feel themselves to be victims of the temptations that they come upon, or that come upon them, and that they're overwhelmed, and that it was something beyond their strength. Whereas in reality, St. Isaac is telling us here that no matter how fierce they might be, that grace is always there, giving us what we need in measure to the spiritual battle that we are facing, or whatever trial it might be in our life too, which I think maybe is even more important, that in the trials and difficulties of our life, to trust that the right amount of grace, the perfect amount of grace is offered to us to be able to endure what we have to endure, and that we aren't going to be left alone, and that we're never alone within the spiritual battle. We might feel ourselves to be in exile, we might feel ourselves to be isolated by the circumstances of our day-to-day life, but in reality, God and God's grace is always there for us, providing with us with exactly what we need. And so, on one level, this is extraordinarily comforting, but on another, it's telling us that we're going to be drawn into that spiritual battle more and more fully. And in order that through that experience, we might set aside our attachment to vice and cling more fully to God's grace, but also seek virtue with a greater rigor as well. And so, in some sense, he's telling us the battle's going to be fierce. Prepare yourself for it. God is not going to shield you from this. In fact, he's calling you to enter into the battle and will allow you to experience it in its fullness, but also will provide you with the grace that is needed. And that this isn't done as a form of punishment for us, that we can expect to experience this in order that we might experience the presence of God in our life more fully. And so that should bring us a kind of joy. So even in the midst of the conflict, when we feel ourselves really pushed to the edge, that underneath all of this should be a kind of peace of resting in Christ and a hopeful kind of joy, knowing that our God will always provide for us, come to our aid in our time of struggle. And so it's, in some sense, a much different vision of the spiritual life than we are often presented with. That I think in our day, there's often a very strong need for experience. And again, things are looked at on an affective level, how, you know, engaging in this kind of prayer, or how this, how our spiritual life makes us feel, you know, in terms of our relationship with God, but very little spoken about what do we do when all of a sudden everything feels hopeless, or we've experienced great failure, or great illness comes upon us, or when we labor for months on end in a kind of spiritual darkness, or we find ourselves overwhelmed by wave after wave of temptation on a daily basis. how are we going to respond at that moment when it's not a tangible consolation that's coming to us? That what we are experiencing, though, is strength in the battle and experiencing it in and through our clinging to God through prayer, but it's not going to be in those moments a kind of happy consolation for us. And if we don't, I think, have this vision of the spiritual life, eventually our knees are going to buckle. Because either we are going to labor under our own strength and experience ourselves as falling, or that we're not going to engage in the spiritual battle at all and be the kind of passive victim, you know, allowing ourselves to be pulled along by our own passions or dragged along by everything that comes to us through the senses, not unprepared, ill-prepared for the spiritual battle altogether. This language of spiritual warfare is not a popular kind of way of talking about the spiritual life. In fact, I purposely chose a book once with that title, thinking that I might draw more men into the group. The machismo kind of thing. You know, the book by Lorenzo Scopoli called Spiritual Combat. And I thought, all right, this might appeal to, you know, those who want to learn how to engage in spiritual warfare. And the mix of the group wasn't tilted towards men. In fact, it was the opposite. And so it's not the kind of language, I think, in our day that we're very comfortable with. Because I think when we think of warfare, we think of how it's enacted in our worldly life and the violence. And we don't like to think of the spiritual life in that way, even though violence, in a sense, is intimately tied, that we are, in a way, in a bloody warfare against the evil one. And the kingdom of heaven suffers violence in the sense that there has to be a willingness to die to self, to die to sin, in order to experience the fullness of life in Christ, that we are willing to slay the ego, if you will, in order to know the true self in Christ. And if we think that we can engage in Christianity, a faith without the cross, then we are cutting out that which is the source of our redemption. And in a sense, it's no longer Christianity. But any questions or comments about the first paragraph and how he's speaking about grace here in temptation? I think it's pertinent, you know, there's all this discussion about a year ago about the translation of the Our Father and, you know, some close scrutiny of how the word was translated and this sort of discomfort with the idea of lead us not into temptation. You know, a desire to translate that in a different way, that the idea of God, you know, leading us into temptation sort of became this unthinkable, unspeakable thought. When I read this paragraph, certainly, and when I've read the Fathers, it's like, no, I mean, this is part of the spiritual life. It's not that God abandons us through that temptation, which is what we're praying for. But we are allowed to experience it and experience it precisely for the reasons that Isaac maps out here for us. And so I think there's a kind of danger because we've already been going down sort of this slippery slope with, you know, Christian spirituality, you know, a movement away from the ascetical life and, you know, a Christianity that does not involve dogma and does not involve a view of the church, sacramentality, but also that is absent asceticism is not Christianity. And so I sort of felt at the time when there was this discussion about it that it wasn't a good time for the discussion, certainly, because we're already laboring under this lack of connection with the spiritual tradition and the ascetical tradition. It would be better to explore that, I think, within the life of the church, in the context of the fullness of our understanding of our relationship with God and the ascetical life and the spiritual life. And certainly, you know, Isaac is saying the same thing, that we're never abandoned and that we're provided with, in perfect measure, with the grace that is needed not to be overcome by that temptation. But nonetheless, we are allowed to experience it for this greater good. And we don't want to lose sight of that. Any other thoughts? Okay. But as soon as grace sees that a little self-esteem has begun to steal into a man's thoughts, and that he has begun to think great things of himself, she immediately permits the temptations opposing him to gain in strength and prevail until he learns his weakness and takes to flight and seeks refuge with God in humility. By these things, a man comes to the stature of a perfect man in the faith and hope of the Son of God and is lifted up unto love. For God's marvelous love of man is made known to him when he is in the midst of circumstances that cut off his hope. Herein God shows his power by saving him. A man can never learn what divine power is while he abides in comfort and spacious living. Moreover, God has never perceptibly shown his action except in a region of stillness, in the desert, and in places bereft of chance encounters with men and of turbulence of their habitations. Now, of course, I think in the last couple sentences, you know, he's speaking particularly about life in the desert and the life of the anchorite, you know, that the comfort that they would seek would be the comfort of communication with others or interaction with others when they've committed themselves to embrace this kind of perfect solitude and silence, to cast off all things in order to seek God alone. And so for them, to seek comfort would be to step out of the silence and the stillness of their cell. And it was no small temptation. And when we read stories of the Desert Fathers, we hear that, you know, that the pull, you know, to listen into conversations, or if somebody walks by, you know, their cave or their hut, you know, all of a sudden, you know, they become wide awake and interested in what's being said and want to enter into the conversation or invite people in for, you know, a little rest or something to eat. You know, that always the temptation for them is to set aside the silence and to set aside the prayer. And so sometimes God would let them be tempted in this way in order to strengthen their embrace of that commitment that the desert included. For us, though, it's, you know, our temptation is to seek, you know, to have our eyes constantly searching for comfort and to gravitate towards that. And he'll talk about this a little bit further on. But here, I think what he wants us to understand is that when we, for a moment, take our eyes off of God and we think that, you know, any gains that we have in the spiritual life have come to us outside of his grace, when we show a kind of pride, then God will pull back his grace, again, not to punish, but to help draw us back to himself, to allow us to see our weakness and poverty in order that we might be perfected through that temptation. And our perfection is found in humility, in imitating the humility, the perfect humility of Christ, who, you know, empties himself fully, abandons himself to the Father's will completely. And this is the image that is to come to perfection within us. And so any aspect of pride that shows itself will quickly be cleansed from us by the experience of these temptations. And so, you know, those who are maybe more advanced in the spiritual life in regards to maybe the more bodily passions, that they struggled for years with, you know, gluttony and lust and avarice, and they've detached themselves, you know, from the things that are connected more to our appetites, and even things such as anger on a certain level too. That the temptations come on the sort of on the higher spiritual plane, with the passions such as sloth or dejection, a kind of listlessness, and you know, envy, pride. That these are where one will often be challenged and tempted, and but nonetheless, the pride, which is struggled with, is this sense of having made these gains and being freed of the lower passions, when in reality that was the easier battle than the struggle with pride. And so, you know, more than one monk threw himself off of a cliff thinking that angels would come to protect him and lift him up. You know, they fell into a kind of delusion because of the pride. And so God would quickly address it. So we must, one of the little notes that I made is we must be taught through hardship. And divine power and stillness is not found in comfort or the company of men, which would be the last part of this paragraph, for the anchorite. And so this is what they must be guarded against the most. Do not be astonished if, when you begin to practice virtue, severe and intense tribulations break out against you from every quarter. For virtue is not accounted virtue if it is not accompanied by the difficulty of labors encountered in accomplishing it. For virtue itself is named for this very fact. As St. John said, it is usual for hardship to assail virtue. Virtue is blameworthy when it is linked to ease. At least in the Latin, virtue comes from virtus, which is like manly, you know, manliness, having a kind of courage in the spiritual battle. And so one who's seeking virtue truly is going to expect tribulations and hardship. He's going to expect a battle, expect a fight, especially if he has this correct vision of the spiritual life and understands himself as a human being. You know, not only the struggle with our own passions, but the fact that we fight a battle with principalities and powers and that do not rest. And so there has to be a kind of courage. And there has to be this clear understanding that a lot is going to be asked from us, that we're going to bear certain scars, that we're going to be humbled, you know, by certain enemies that afflict us, and or by the vices that, you know, bring ourselves down. Who I just read this today, I don't know if it was Chrysostom saying that, you know, the pride is like when an enemy shoots an arrow at you and you catch it in your hand and then you stab yourself in the heart with the arrow. So it's sort of what I think Isaac is talking about here, you know, that we can, you know, it's pride, our own pride can bring us down and by our own hand. And the Blessed Mark, the monk, has said, every virtue on being achieved is called a cross, and when it fulfills the Spirit's commandment. That is why all those who wish to fear the fear of the Lord, to live in Jesus Christ, will suffer persecution. For he says, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. If any man will quicken his soul with comforts, he shall lose it. And if any man loseth it for my sake, he shall find it. For this reason, then, he has gone in advance and has set the cross in front of you, that you might sentence yourself to death, and then send forth your soul to go after him. So, I don't know if it could be put in any more stark way than this. I mean, it's certainly a reflection of the gospel, which he quotes about denying oneself, taking up one's cross and following him and dying to oneself. But this idea of sentencing oneself to death, that like Christ, you know, it's nobody forces this upon me. I choose it of my own will. I make my way to fulfill the Father's will, knowing what lies ahead. And in a similar way, as Christian men and women, we have to expect that if we put on the mind of Christ and if we conform ourselves to his image, if it's his spirit that dwells within us, then we are going to face the same hatred from the world or the fallen world. We're going to face the same hatred from the evil one. And the only way to make our way through this is from the beginning to sentence ourselves to death, that we're telling ourselves the cross is always going to be a part of our life, that the shape of Christian love is cruciform, and the cross always stands before us as the model and the shape of our love. And we have to be prepared from that right from the beginning. In fact, die to self, self-will, selfishness, to live for God alone. And to do that means also we are going to become vulnerable to the hatred of the world that had crucified him first. And this was done. He goes before us in order to teach us this. And, you know, we shouldn't be ashamed, I think, to feel a kind of fear and trembling in the face of this, knowing that the apostles did. You know, they all abandoned him, and they're all, you know, huddled, hidden away in a locked-up room, fearing that the same thing would happen to them. Peter denies him three times. You know, Judas, of course, you know, sells him out for 30 shekels of silver. And then, you know, the apostles on their road, the disciples on the road to Emmaus are fleeing, you know, fleeing town, and he, you know, has to rebuke them. Do you not know from that the scriptures have taught this, and that this is the way that redemption comes to us? This is the path that you are to follow. And after hearing them, and once the word makes their hearts begin to burn within them, then they turn back toward Jerusalem. They turn back, as it were, toward the cross, no longer fearing it, but being strengthened now through the encouragement that he gave them in the breaking of the bread, that they're nourished upon the very love that then they are called to manifest to the world. The self-sacrificing love that pours out from the cross is what we receive in the Holy Eucharist. Strengthened by this, then, they can turn back to Jerusalem in order to pour themselves out in love in the very same way. And so again, you know, while piercing, there's also something liberating, I think, in reading this because of the nature of its clarity, and that the gospel suddenly becomes illuminated in a way for us, I think, when we read Isaac and other dozen fathers, but in particular Isaac, that it becomes like a magnifying glass for us. It's not saying something different from the gospel, but all of a sudden we're seeing it through a lens that makes it painfully clear to us. That at times in reading the gospel over and over again, or hearing the same stories read at Mass, you know, it can become something that is overly familiar to us, and we can sanitize it. We can domesticate the gospel, and in the sense that we strip it of the cross. But when you read Isaac and other saints, you know, they pull that back and to focus for us, knowing that we might fear it. And in the same way that the apostles did, and certainly in the same way that they probably did in their spiritual struggles. And so they put it before us with this kind of clarity, saying, expect this, you know, this is what you're going to face. Trust in the grace of God that is given to you, even if you are fearful and anxious. Anything about these first couple paragraphs? Yes.
This is slightly vague thought, mm-hmm. but when we were reading the first paragraph and then we got to the second one, It's interesting because I was thinking of this psalm that I've been reading right before this. That was, and then the second paragraph just followed so beautifully on it. I guess what I'm thinking, the psalm I was reading was 32, and it has this line in it, at a time of distress in the rush of great waters, they shall not reach him. You are a hiding place for me. You preserve me from trouble. You surround me with deliverance. And I was just thinking about the idea of what a hiding place really is. And I thought it was said very beautifully here at the end of that second paragraph, at the top of 504, you know, God shows his power by saving him. It's almost like the psalm is paraphrased in the paragraph, which is amazing. Hearing God shows his power by saving him, a man can never learn what divine power is while he abides in comfort and spacious living. God has never perceptibly shown his action except in a region of stillness, in the desert, and in places bereft of chance encounters with men and the turbulence of their habitations. And I'm just thinking, like, hiding places are typically not like luxurious or comfortable spaces. Like every story about a person hiding, it's a hardship. Like there's this, there was this group of, I want to say like Dutch families, I'm probably butchering this, but Dutch Jewish families, or like three of them, and there were these subterranean, you know, these caves, like deeply subterranean caves, very shallow caves. And they went like 2 miles into them, into the earth, to hide from the Nazis. And they lived there for like over 2 years. And they had almost no food. So they slept over 18 hours a day so that their bodies would be preserved on almost no food. And there was no room to stand. So they just lay down for like 2 years. And there were like kids with them, like they had little kids who like grew up for a couple of years in that. And they did that with just the hope of one day being able to make their way out of the caves, for just like this life, you know? And the Amish have this beautiful little children's story about the predatory bird and the really colorful, beautiful bird that just like rejoices in its life and in all the beautiful colors that it is, but it's the first thing that the predator sees, and so it gets snatched up. And then there's the little, like, humble, plain brown bird who doesn't rejoice a lot in this life, but it's safe because it can hide. And like, what is our experience of God being a hiding place for us? Like, sometimes I think that's like loneliness and stillness and darkness, and maybe like not the most comfortable thing in this life, but like he's our hiding place. And there's no getting around the fact that like in this world there are an enormous amount of temptations and an enormous amount of dangers where we can very easily be hurt or killed. And like we're just not going in this life to ever be able to fully live, like scriptures say, like in the freedom of the children of God. Like in this life, we're constrained by the fact that there is a terrible and powerful being that desires nothing else but our death and destruction and damnation. Like, and that's just the reality. Like, there's no moment in that this life where that's not true. Like, there is something out to get us all the time. And so we have to spend a good deal of our life hiding. And like, that's really hard, but it is like very full of love because the one we hide in does love us. So it's sort of like suffering with love is transformed into sacrifice, which is something beautiful. It's sort of like God is our hiding place, and because he loves us, that's transferred into salvation, which is very beautiful. But like, the hiding place isn't going to be like the prettiest way to live or like this life in a worldly sense, like, you know?
Yeah, not in a worldly sense, but I think if you look to the saints, you know, it's mystically, I think they would see it as the heart of Christ, that this is where we would hide ourselves, and this is our safety. Philip Neri had this saying that let us enter into the side of Christ and, you know, lose ourselves so completely that we never find our way out again, that this is the hiding place for us, the place that we're protected and find strength and peace living in this world until we come to experience that in all of its fullness. And but that, you know, I think Philip came to experience that in the depths of prayer, you know, that he did hide himself, as it were, in the catacombs, sort of what you were talking about, you know, 10 years, this first 10 years in Rome, all night long in prayer, and so many other saints doing the same. It was like these monks, you know, going into the desert, you know, hiding, living in these caves. But again, not as an escape, you know, I think in some sense entering into the very heart of the world, because they're entering into the heart of Christ through this deep prayer. And I think all this talk of grace that he's drawing us through, even though it's peppered with the realities of spiritual warfare, is meant to be this kind of encouragement to lose ourselves, if you will, within the grace of God to such an extent that, you know, we become that perfect person like Christ, that whatever happens to us within this world, we know cannot destroy us, that it's, you know, we are strengthened by he who is the Lord of history, you know, the governor of history, the Lord of life. And so what do we have to be anxious about? And one only comes to know this comfort, though, I think, when deeply immersed within the heart of Christ, which, you know, has always been the simple symbol of the, you know, the love of God, the perfect love of God, the heart that was pierced for love of us. Yes.
So, I thought that was really interesting, first of all, I'm not saying I'm right, but I guess I had a slightly different thought towards the end where, like, I'm not sure we are meant to, like, I don't know, hide from a big, powerful being that's bent to kill us for our damnation. And I guess I'm only saying that because as I was reading or listening to the early part, or the first part of it, like, I don't know, whenever I read Isaac, he always, for whatever reason, it always, like, differently than other things, but forces me to just naturally start thinking about, like, myself and my kids. And, like, the big powerful being is God, and I feel like he's not out to kill us. There's, like, this weak, cowardly little snivelly person compared to him that's out. And I don't mean that, like, whatever. I mean, I guess it depends on who you're comparing, yourself or you're comparing God. And like, I look at it from, like, you know, so, like, I guess I was listening to the beginning of it, and it just made me think of, like, my children when they're learning to walk, and then they fall, and I've got other kids that learn quicker to do physical things, so to say, than others, and others mental things quicker than others, but, you know, and the ones that are, like, pushing you off, like, fine, I'll let you do it, and then when you get hurt, you're going to learn to let me help you next time type of deal, and hopefully that happens. It doesn't always, but, I mean, you know, eventually they kind of let you, but, you know, the ones that are pushing themselves to do it end up falling and getting covered in bruises and stuff all the time quicker. But, like, when they fall and break their arm, you know, like, you're the one scooping them up and bringing them to the doctor and having the bone set. And so I guess I get that, but to me the hiding from it, or the whatever, is more like God. If you don't put your kid down and you just hold him forever, because you could want to do that and you don't want him to get hurt, but then he's never going to learn to walk, you know? But then the kid, you have to, like, let him walk. He's going to get hurt, and you always scoop him up. And so I feel like at a certain point, there's, like, a walking, but there's the confidence that, like, you're surrounded by like when you fall, you get picked up, and it's sort of like, it's not as much as like getting beaten down as much as it is like learning in the process, and it hurts to learn, but you, I don't know, it's the only way to do it. And sometimes even the bigger, like the bigger falls, or you learn a little bit more, and maybe you do learn to hide or to not do something, so to say, but you don't, I don't know. I guess that was just like how I was thinking about it too, because of my kids, and I do, honestly, I have one kid that learned to ride a bike without training wheels before he turned 3, and it's like, he's also the one that's always banging his head on stuff and falling out of tree, you know, stuff, things, so it's like, I don't know. I guess it's just a slightly different take on that, but...
Which is good. I mean, I think both are beautiful. And I don't think we're limited to one meaning alone. You know, I think whenever we look at the scriptures, I mean, every priest that you hear preach the gospel on any given day is going to see another facet of that. And so I certainly see what you're saying and what Isaac is talking about here, that God allows us to experience something of that battle to teach us. And so he doesn't coddle, you know, that he gives us what is needed to engage in the struggle, but allows us to struggle in order that we might experience what we need to. But at the same time that we are given this extraordinary source of comfort, you know, that within the world, you know, our one sure source of strength and protection is God. It's, you know, not found in ourselves. It's only by, you know, what he's talking about here, you know, sentencing ourselves to death and then send forth your soul to go after him. You know, it's allowing ourselves to, you know, lose ourselves completely in order to give ourselves over to him fully as well. And that's where a real freedom comes from. And that's sort of what the Desert Fathers did. You know, they sentenced themselves to death. You know, they went out into the desert and, you know, where they were stripped of everything. And they would simultaneously see this as a place of battle, of mortification, but they also saw it as paradise, you know, precisely because of the intimacy that they experienced with God in the desert. So I think both of what you're saying, the two of you are saying, both things are true. You know, it's seeing, you know, a different facet, I think, of what he's articulating here. Yes, Tyson. Speak up with the mask.
Right. What you're saying right now, this vision of paradise, even this of suffering and temptation, sort of reminds me, one of the most humbling, I guess, spiritual writings that I've read recently, I guess. I read it with a friend very recently, this Uniformity with God's Will by Sam Francis.
Liguori?
Yes. It's a very short letter, so if you guys haven't read it, I would highly recommend it. But in it, he sort of makes the distinction between mere conformity with God's will, which is simply accepting his will. So the suffering's consent is simply accepting it.
Right.
And then uniformity with God's will, which is to be unified with his will, simply to will what he wills.
Right.
And then so to say, I gladly welcome the suffering that comes to me, knowing that it comes from God's hands,
right,
is to taste heaven here on earth. Do the saints in heaven who are completely uniform with his will, essentially loving him, being that his will and what he wills. And then he goes, I guess even he really spells that out for you. He says, if someone, you know, hits you, God didn't will that you, that God didn't will that person's ill intention or that person's sin, but he certainly willed your humiliation, saying, anything that materially happens to us, God consents to materially, so therefore, whatever that is, we accept as his will. And then in terms of spiritual issues, he also talks about temptation. So long as we don't consent to the temptation, we don't sin, but the temptation itself is certainly coming from God's hands, so therefore it must be a part of his will, and his will is only for the good, at least for those who do truly love him, quoting scripture. Therefore, and then he says, thank God that he's wrapped us in his love, meaning the temptation. And so those are really hard words, I think, for us today, because we are, at least for anyone, to imagine, well, someone's wronged me. Clearly that's an evil. But then to read that, at least, and then he points to the saints, those, you know, at least the disciples who rejoiced when they were deemed worthy to suffer for the sake of Christ. So the idea that anything that may happen to us, whether we agree with it or not, disagree with it, to see that in light of God's love, and then to trust that God's love is ultimately for the salvation of my soul, as well as the souls of everyone else, as opposed to necessarily the alleviation of suffering, which really, I think, like you said, is perhaps hard to understand unless we accept, I guess, the aspects of the faith that you said are maybe lacking.
Unless we embrace the mystery of the cross, and you know, I think this throws us all the way back toward the beginning, where Isaac talks about the knowledge of the cross is found in the cross, that it's in the experience of it itself that one experiences also this perfect love of God made manifest. It's only by our entering into that self-emptying kind of love that we see its beauty. And I think in a similar way, you know, Paul talked about that in terms of Christ being made perfect through what he suffered, that there's a manifestation of the perfection of that love that is revealed to the world when Christ abandons himself completely to the Father's will, even to death on the cross. And it's in that that we see the perfection of love. Not that the perfect love wasn't present in him, but it is made manifest in its perfection through his suffering, where it poured out completely. Nothing is withheld, but he pours himself out completely upon the cross until he breathes his last upon the cross. And from that moment on, the cross becomes for us, you know, not the instrument of the execution, but now it becomes for us the image of the perfect love of God and the mercy of God. And I don't think Isaac is trying to tell us anything different than what we find in the scriptures, that it's only by our willingness to say yes to that mystery that might be frightening to us, might be confusing to us, to allow ourselves to be drawn on, as you were saying, quoting Alphonsus, you know, into a greater perfection, into saying yes to that will of the Father until we will what he wills. And that essentially is to be perfectly conformed to Christ, to will what the Father wills without any hesitation, without any doubt, and not holding anything back. And I think that's, you know, this is sort of the training of the Spirit to bring us to that point. You know, we're being filled with this perfect love of God, you know, gradually until we are made perfect, until we can will what God wills and not fear it. Well, why don't we just follow Isaac on a little bit further here and see where he leads us. Where did I leave off? Can anybody help me?
Not
even strong. Okay. Oh, boy. This is just when you thought those other paragraphs were hard. Nothing is stronger than desperation. It knows no defeat at the hand of any, whether they be on the right or on the left. When in his mind a man cuts away any hope for his life, nothing can equal him in daring. None of his foes is able to face him, and there is no affliction, the rumor of which makes his purpose weaken. For every affliction which may befall him is lighter than death, whereas he has bowed his head to receive precisely this. if in every place and under every circumstance and on every occasion, in all that you wish to undertake, you set labors and grief as the aim of your resolution, you will find yourself at all times courageous and unhesitant in standing up against every seeming difficulty. Furthermore, through the power of your deliberations, all thoughts that dismay and frighten you will take flight from you, since these are customarily engendered in men by thoughts that look to comfort. Thus all things difficult and harsh that you encounter will be light and easy for you. And indeed, your affairs often turn out contrary to what you expected, and perhaps you will never encounter any of those difficulties. So it's desperation that allows us to experience the reality of a real hope in God. You know, it allows us to let go of looking for comfort in the things of this world, all of which are passing. And our minds always go back to them. We're always searching for something that will comfort a kind of dis-ease or restlessness within the human heart. And so as soon as something presents itself to us, our minds immediately go there, and we're pulled away. It's used to pull us away from the will of God. Whereas if we have set in our mind that God has revealed himself in and through the perfect love of the cross, that this is the standard for us, and that in a sense we've already died to this part of ourselves that wants to seek comfort in the world, and we seek our comfort and our hope only in God, then we become fearless. And he says daring, that anything now that the world might present to us, any kind of physical suffering, any kind of emotional or spiritual suffering, is no threat to us, because we know death itself has been conquered, and it's been conquered precisely through the love of the cross. And so if we cling to the cross in the sense that this is the lens through which we see the world, and that we die to self and this constant need to comfort or expect comfort, then all of a sudden there's a freedom and peace that comes to us. And this is not resignation. You know, this kind of, what descriptor would I want here to maybe help us? You know, a kind of, not just passive resignation, but, you know, a kind of resignation that sort of like, that gives up, you know, on everything, you know, just that there's no hope in anything at all. Whereas this kind of letting go of our hope in the world allows us to find true hope, which is found in Christ. And having that, then we fear nothing whatsoever that the world might throw at us. And it can throw a lot at us. You know, part of, I understood what you were saying, Daniel, about, you know, this idea of this, you know, beast, you know, constantly threatening us, you know, but on some level, you know, we are presented in the world by this relentless enemy that seeks to draw us into, you know, this pursuit of a limited worldly comfort and this constant seduction by it. I deserve this. You know, I should have some happiness within the world. You know, if I don't, you know, where is God? You know, if he's not answering my prayer for this, then God has, you know, abandoned me. You know, how many people have gone down this road where they've cast off everything in regards to their faith or commitments or whatever it might be because they were drawn towards something that their heart felt that it needed, you know, and it drew them in, that their life would be incomplete, they would be unhappy unless they possessed it. And so for what became the pearl of great price for them, or the treasure hidden in the field, was not Christ and the love of Christ, but rather something that had the illusion of that for them, that in their mind or was put before them as a temptation is elevated to this pedestal of being God. It becomes an idol for them. And we all know that that can happen with like worldly loves too. You know, that we love who we love. And so, you know, that becomes sort of the excuse to take a person anywhere they want to go because they have convinced themselves that fulfillment and happiness is only to be found in that relationship or, you know, pursuing that particular goal. And it doesn't take a genius to see this. I mean, we must walk around in this constant fog not to see it, but all the energy that is... Yesterday, we were watching a little bit of the Steelers football game, you know, and I was over visiting. And even with, like, what is it, 5,000 people in the stands now, you know, there's this whole machine that drives this, you know, of millions of dollars and, you know, the camera work and all the players being paid these huge salaries, this huge stadium, everybody, you know, still people, millions of people watching on television. And, you know, you have to say that people find a deep solace in watching a football game on television on Sunday. It's like this escape. You know, it's not of the magnitude of what I was just talking about, but it's one of the momentary things that we often will give ourselves, you know, that this is a kind of comfort that we will often choose over and above God, and we'll immerse ourselves in it and become obsessed with it, fanatics about it. The only thing that you can't be a fanatic about, seemingly, is your relationship with God. You can be a fanatic about fishing and art and every other thing in this world, but being a fanatic about God, no way. And so you could see how there is this constant struggle that we are under to embrace this simple truth, which is the truth of the cross. It's put before us so starkly by the saints. We celebrated the feast of the North American martyrs today, you know, that left their home country, had to learn a new language, you know, the language of, you know, these Indian tribes, you know, have to travel across country in canoe and, you know, to, you know, through this foreign land and in these harsh conditions. And then, you know, they meet with, you know, tribes that have very different mentalities, and the Iroquois, you know, want nothing to do with them, and then, you know, torture them. And Isaac Jogues had his fingertips bitten off, and things like that. And, you know, so we have this constant image that the church puts before us, the cross constantly held out before us. We have the constant witness of the saints and the martyrs preaching the same thing, but all, you know, very easily this veil comes over our eyes. And the veil is that our thoughts look to comfort. You know, it's always that same thing, you know, that when we feel, you know, a kind of emptiness or void, or we're going through suffering, you know, it's that comfort that comes back into our mind, and we want to get, we want to free ourselves from it in one way or another. And if we can't, we become angry at God and turn away from God, you know, because, you know, we're not able to find it, or he's not giving it. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, okay.
I saw.
Okay. You know, conversation now. So here's what I thought. Because I just, like, when I listen to you talking about your children, I just think, like, my experience of the things I've done in my life feels like nothing like a little child who just stumbles because they're trying to learn how to walk, right? Like, it was so much more of a choice, and a bad one. and what I'm thinking is, like, that experience of, like, the little child who gets hurt and stumbles because they don't, like, know quite how to, like, be a human yet, right? Like, they don't know how to walk yet or do these other things. And then they get hurt, and immediately they allow their loving parent to, like, scoop them up and make it better. And I think that's how we were supposed to be, right? Like Adam and Eve they were made without sin, but not, like, perfectly glorified, right? So there's sort of this idea that, like, they would have still, like, learned and been brought deeper into relationship with God. But then your kids grow up, and then they go through what we charmingly call a rebellious period, and we think it's funny, but it's like they're not just going through a period where they're making bigger mistakes. They're going through a period where they actively rebel because they will not obey an authority greater than themselves. And it's like, you are my parent, and because you are my parent, I defy you. Even if it means, or like, God, I defy you, or I defy whatever, even if it means, like, I'm putting myself in dangerous and harmful situations that I know are dangerous and harmful, and that's part of the thrill, because I'm curious, and I want something out of it. And we make morally dangerous choices where we distance ourselves from our parents, and our parents would love to be there. Well, some people's parents would love to be there to scoop them up and make them better. But you leave your parents on purpose so that they aren't there to warn you and say no, so that you can just go do what you want. And I think, like, that's sort of what I'm thinking of, is like, and we're in this, the reality is, whether we acknowledge his existence or not, that there is, like, there is, not in comparison to God, powerful, but in comparison to us, incredibly powerful and malicious person who's there all the time, like the bad influence, saying, yeah, your parents suck. Like, this is awful. Like, you need to get away from them. There's so much more to see and experience in life. They're being so restrictive. They're not letting you have any freedom or any fun. And, like, I know, I mean, it didn't have to do with parents, but it had to do with other positive role models. Like, I definitely listened to that and chose it, like, so intentionally and actively. And I just feel like there's an important distinction there, because, like, when Christ says, like, to become childlike, I think that's exactly the relationship he wants us to enter into. Like, I remain in his presence, I become a little child, and inevitably I'm going to stumble and I'm going to fall, but he's going to be right there because I remain in his presence, and so that he can be right there to help me and protect me when I inevitably stumble. And then there's when we banish him, we run away from his presence and expose ourselves to all these things, and in that arena, like, it's just like constant danger and, like, grievous danger. And if we would run back to the Father as our, like, safety place, as our, like, protection, our hiding place, you know, then our experience of it wouldn't be so immediate, which is sort of what they're talking about. But I guess for me, I just feel, like, so compelled to accept the enormous evil and power of Satan. Like, honestly, I mean, it's like, look what he's done. Like, look at the world, look at people. Like, just, you know, obviously to question his power in comparison to God, I think, makes sense. But in comparison to us, like, he is clearly more powerful than us and smarter than us, because he has turned our world upside down. Right.
Well, you know, I think, you know, even with, like, St. Therese, the whole, you know, teaching on spiritual childhood, you know, arises out of a young woman who, from a very early age, you know, all of what we find in Isaac was telescoped in her. You know, she lived this very short life. Grace was really active and powerful in her, and she enters into the Carmel, which, you know, was a kind of dying to self, you know, and they entered, it was pretty clear they were dying to the world and they were living for Christ alone. And it's out of this experience that I think this childlike trust and, you know, fearlessness even that a child will have because of the presence of the Father emerges. but I don't, it doesn't emerge, I think, prior to this kind of, sentencing to death that Isaac speaks of. And it's exactly what Therese did. It's not that the Carmel, it's not that it necessitates entering into the Carmel or entering into the desert, but I think in our day-to-day life, this is what is to be made manifest. Except I was the perfect unrebellious son, of course. Never put my parents through any grief. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. Daniel, I don't want to cut you off, but I want to try to do this one last paragraph. If you don't mind, we'll take this, maybe a little 5 minutes longer, but it's tied to what we read here, and I don't want to lose the connection here. You yourself know that at all times the hope of comfort is one to make men forget what is great and good and virtuous. Unless they resolve in their minds to suffer hardships, not even those who are found in this present world in the life of the flesh can attain the end of their desire. And since experience testifies to this, there is no need to prove it with words. For in every generation of those who have gone before us, even until now, it is this and nothing else that has made men feeble, so that they do not gain victories and are hindered from excellent deeds. Therefore, to sum up, we say, no man disdains the kingdom of the heavens except in hope of some small comfort in this life. And not only does he suffer this, but also many times mighty onslaughts and fearful temptations are prepared for the man who sets comfort as the aim of his will and whose thoughts follow after it, because that which governs him is desire. And so the desire that governs him is the desire for comfort to be found in the things of this world, rather than that, we had discussed so many times desire having its root in and meaning in the word that describes a sense of lack and incompleteness. The person of faith recognizes that we are made whole, we are made complete only in and through our union and communion with God. He alone is our comfort, our hope, our salvation. And the seduction is, as it was for Adam and Eve, to seek it in ourselves, separated from him. In the world itself, take for yourself, eat of the fruit, your eyes will be open, you will see good and evil, and you'll be like gods. And so it's trying to seek that comfort arising out of ourself as our own creation, something that we've made or discovered or brought about. And so that's why he's so pointed. It only takes, hope and some small comfort in this world at times to derail us from seeking our hope and comfort in God and God alone. And the evil one is incredibly seductive in that way of presenting us with so many different things that are, a delight to the senses or, make us think in our mind, if we just possessed this, we would be happy. Or if we were free from this, we would be happy. If our life had taken another path, we would be happy. And so, it's kind of an interesting thing. Hope comes to us when we have no hope in this world. It's not that we can't have or experience joy with each other and in the genuine things of life, family life, marriage, friendship, but we don't turn those into idols for ourselves in the sense of how we live our life and the path that we pursue. And so often God is out at the margins or out of the picture altogether in our minds. Yes, Daniel.
I've been thinking a lot about the Abraham sacrifice, and one of the things that stands out often to me
is the fact that he sacrifices Isaac, but I mean technically he doesn't sacrifice Isaac, but in a certain way it's like he does sacrifice Isaac, obviously, but he gets Isaac back for sacrificing Isaac. And I think that, like, to go piggyback on what you're saying, like, even when we talk about, like, you know, you can enjoy the comforts of the earth and stuff, it's like, if we sacrifice them all to God, you know, at the moment of truth, I guess you could say, oftentimes we find that we actually get it back, you might say, but we get it back from the hand of God. And it's, does that make sense?
Yeah, because that was true for Abraham, that this willingness to will what God seemingly willed, you know, to take that path. And, you know, for Abraham, you know, there must have been this incredible conflict, not only in the thought of having to sacrifice his son, but there's also this promise that God would raise up, you know, generations upon generations, you know, from him. And here Abraham was an old man and Sarah was old and they had already, you know, conceived in, you know, sort of a miraculous way. And so it's like,
yes,
Abraham was
God made it as impractical and impossible as he could.
Right. But then telling him, you know, to let go of it, you know, again, not to cling to it as an end in itself. Because you could see how that would be true for Abraham, that, you know, I'll, you know, from you, then I will raise up a mighty nation, and, you know, finally having a son, you know, that could sort of become the end in itself, that he could lose sight of the relationship with God and the relationship of faith that allowed this to emerge. And so Abraham has to be willing to let go of the very thing that seems to hold out promise to him in this world. Whereas God is really, what this really prefigures is something far greater. That God is going to provide the lamb of sacrifice. You know, that what he asks of Abraham, and but stays his hand, he does himself. He provides, he offers his own son in order that we might have the fullness of life.
And I think that's the irony with, if you want to tie it back all the way to the beginning of Genesis with the Adam and Eve story, is that, like, mm-hmm. I think, and this is my speculation, but I think that the story of Abraham, because you talk about deification a lot mm-hmm. in this, and it's like, that's basically what Adam and Eve were promised by the devil, of course, but in a certain way, it was just like, that was what they were promised, and that's actually what God ultimately gives. So there's a certain hint with the Abraham story that, like, if Adam and Eve were to done the right thing, they would have got to eat the apple anyway. They would have got everything. Yeah. They would have got God, and they would have got that
right.
apple.
That's right.
And I'm just, and I think that, like,
nobody said we were bright. Daniel.
This is one of my favorite parts of this book, but I think that it's, I find it very, like, clear and easy to understand about, like, desperation and nothing being stronger, and, like, there's just the Bible, from my perspective, it's, like, littered with examples of it. For instance, there's the rich young man, when he's talking about comforts, and it's also that I see it so practical because of the world we live in, and I mean, you know, everything is constantly marketed to you, right? And if you do just, I mean, innocently want to watch a little bit of a football game, you're still bombarded with 19 million advertisements in between it all, which in and of itself, I guess, I'm not trying to say is like this innate bad thing, but it's just one more step of like, well, if you have a new phone, and if you have a new this, and if you have a new that, and if you had a bigger house, and if you had a newer car, whatever it is, you know, like all the different commercials that are just out there. But you have the rich young man, and he goes away sad because he made an idol out of keeping the commandments. I mean, in all reality, not that that's a bad thing to do, but he attained to salvation himself, in a sense. And then on the, and then you even almost have Peter, who at times has like an idol of his own ego, because he's one of, you know, he's always in the inner circle, and he's kind of like, you know, it seems like he's always a little bit of the favorite one in the inner circle in a sense. And I will never, even if the rest of them abandon you, I won't. And it's like, okay, well, you will. And he keeps warning of that too. Like, the moment you let that self, that ego kind of slip in, then God's going to say, all right, here's enough rope to hang yourself in a sense. You know what I mean? And then, and that's what happened there. And it wasn't until then, in that same thing that he did, and he denies Christ, that the desperation sets in. And he's like, oh my gosh, like every time I do this, or every time I say, the desperation kicked in. And he went and like just sobbed and wept. And he did not necessarily see himself as, well, and I will no longer deny Christ. Like there is, he sees himself as very clear, as the man who has set himself, set the cross in a sense at that point forward in front of him. And then, like, but it's not even just that story. It's why Christ says there's prostitutes and tax collectors entering the kingdom of God before you, to the Pharisees. Or again, there's the rich young man who's kept all the commandments, goes away sad. But then there's the woman caught in adultery who, like, has, you know, can't even lift her head. And Christ is like, go and sin no more. And she goes off rejoicing. And there's the, you know, I mean, there's the thief on the cross who talked about desperation. It's like, well, fuck, I can't really change my circumstances, it's what it is here, you know? Like, it's just so funny, because it's like, in all of those, it's not the person who's necessarily always got their stuff together before they do it. And so in every one of those circumstances, there's desperation, you know? There's the desperation of the one, trying to find them. In a sense, it's even Mary Magdalene, Zacchaeus, it's, you know, it's probably Matthew, you know what I mean? Like, it's a tax collector. It's just on and on. It's always the desperate one. So I really like this part of it. So that's all. It's more of like, yeah.
No, I agree. It's one of the most beautiful parts of the book, I think. It's challenging.
I love that sentence, that nothing is stronger than desperation. Mm-hmm. And I thought of the type of desperation that we've all talked about. But this paragraph reminds me of like the mindset of a martyr. And so when I was reading the paragraph, it almost became a witness of what a martyr, like what their mindset might be. And I was thinking there's two types of desperation that I could think of. One is a desperate desire to escape one's circumstances. Like, for example, the prodigal son. But a second type of desperation is like a desperation born out of love. Like in the Song of Songs. Or the Song of Songs, where the bride is desperate to pursue the bridegroom, and even to the point of bloodying her feet. And like, if you look at that previous paragraph, send forth your soul to go after him. That's what that reminded me of. And I was thinking about how not only can you have those two types of desperation, but one can transform into the other. That you can begin at a point of desperation to escape your circumstances, and that can be transfigured into a desperation born out of love, and a desire to pursue the bridegroom. And it almost seems like that's what the martyrs perhaps give witness to.
Right. Yeah. One would even think that that would be the natural course of things, that one would pass through the one to the other, the one form of desperation where that leads to the sort of detachment from the things of this world. The other desperation is for the one alone who offers hope, which is the bridegroom.
And Mary Magdalene would be like the most perfect example of that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, coming to the tomb at night, or yeah, even though, then, coming to the tomb, even
yeah,
though
and
all reason.
Yeah, and then desperate, like, where if you put him, I'll carry off this, you know, 200-pound man, because I'll be able to carry him all by myself. And
wow, your image of Jesus is buff. 200-pound.
And it's like, you know, where if you put it in, she's so desperate. And then she's so desperate, Jesus even has to, like, kind of correct her a little bit. Like, just don't cling, you know, to me as you knew me and loved me. And then after he ascends, she goes and lives the rest of her life in a cave. And it's like the perfect icon of that transformation of desperation. It's very beautiful.
It reminds me of that quote you frequently post by St. Porphyrios about loving and suffering. I don't remember exactly. To love is to suffer is to love. And rather than being a resignation, it's almost like a passionate intensity.
I think it is hard to imagine the sense of embracing something or willing what God wills. You know, what Tyson had said earlier, that we could will it, you know, with that, you know, kind of confidence in the love of God and so freely. Because often we will endure things, we'll persevere through things, embracing the will of God that we encounter in our life, but this sense of running towards it or heading towards it freely to embrace it is something that is hard to understand. And I think we only come to know it through the experience as we're taught by the grace of God and the way that Isaac lays it out here. That's what it is beautiful. I've never heard it described this way, of grace. How grace teaches us through experience. There's a kind of clarity and beauty to it that I haven't found anywhere else. Okay, well, we stop there for tonight and we'll pick up next week. Okay. In the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you. May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Go in peace. Thanks be to God. Thank you all. It's great to be back.